There will be no personal nor direct attacks on anyone. And I would ask that you please try to keep down the loud cheering and the clapping. There will be no booing and no unruly behavior. With that,
this is painful, and it will be for a long time.
Donald Trump, baby! That's right, this man knows what's up!
After all, these are a couple of high-stepping turkeys, and you know what to say about a high-stepper. No step too high for a high-stepper.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Well, Sean's a tough guy. I mean, I think everybody knows that. You know, Sean, he took some licks. He hangs in there.
Yeah, what's wrong with the beer we got? I mean, the beer we got drank pretty good, don't it?
Did you hear what I said?
So this is a brave council. I had no doubt about them.
That doesn't suck.
If you don't like it, too bad.
Last question. Were you high on drugs?
Last question. Kiss my...
All right, here we go. FM Talk 106.5 Midday Mobile. Glad to have you along on this Veterans Day edition of the show. And a reminder, too, it's Veterans Month all month long here at FM Talk 106.5. So we will continue to do our interviews with veterans all the month of November. Actually, I got started in October, and all those interviews are whatever I said earlier. The fancy people say they're curated. We just put them all in one place, gathered them up on our website at fmtalk1065.com. You'll see the tab along the top. Click that, and you go through those interviews. And another one coming up today, and good to see this man in studio, my friend, and usually we're in here talking about some politics and what's going on in the city of Saraland, but today we're going to talk about veterans and his family. It's Wayne Biggs joining us. Thanks for your time.
Well, thank you, Sean. It's a pleasure to be here and an honor to be here on a day that celebrates the people who make our life in America possible.
100%. And, you know, big thank you. You've been involved with us in our coverage for Veterans Day each year. We thank you for that with Azalea City. Thank you.
Proud to do that.
It's going to be obvious to y'all here how ingrained this is in Wayne Biggs' life. Just got back. You're out on the West Coast. Took a little trip.
Went to San Diego. My wife and I went out to visit our Cali kids. My youngest son, Matthew, is a 22-year veteran of the United States Marine Corps. He is the operations chief for First Fleet for the Marines stationed at Camp Pendleton. They're fortunate enough to live on Coronado Island, though.
Pretty spot.
And so we love to go out there and visit. And they had a lot of activities the last 2 weeks.
They had celebrating. They had a party, didn't they?
They had several parties. And just had a great time out there in the celebrations of the Marine Corps' 250th birthday. And we threw in a 20th birthday for our granddaughter while we were out there as well.
Good stuff. Yeah, and by the way, so tell your son the same thing I tell Tom Claxton, Cal Walters, and all those guys. Y'all don't look a day over 247. Like, y'all 250, but your Marines, I wouldn't have gotten you over 247. All right, and I'll start the next part of this. So you're talking about your son, but I want to talk about your father. And I mentioned this at the beginning of the show, and I want to just set this up, and you can fill in some details where I miss out, and I want to hear about, you know, your connection to this. But this is one hell of a thing in American history that has not gotten the attention I think it deserves out there. So it's January of 1945, and it's a raid behind enemy lines, the great raid of Kabanatom, or you can help me pronounce that correctly. You got 500 American and Filipino soldiers held captive there. Now, this is people that had marched the Bataan Death March,
correct,
moved to this camp. The Japanese are holding them there. They're starving, disease-ridden. And there's also a memo, if I think this correctly, that goes out from a Japanese commander, says, we got a plan to kill American POWs.
Exactly.
Certain things happen. They're dead. They'd already done it once before.
They had it at Palawan.
Yes.
They had taken, I think, a couple of hundred POWs into an air raid shelter, douse them in diesel fuel, set them on fire, and any that ran out were machine gunned down. And so the edict came from Tokyo that there would be no POWs released back, so that the potential to be there to fight again.
To kill them.
So the edict was that they were to exterminate all of those. And word got out to the command, and they knew that they had these 500-plus POWs, and some were civilians, and there were British soldiers. There were, I think, Australian. There were Filipino and Americans. But they were the people that could not be transported to Japan to be to work in the plants, in the munition factories and stuff. Their health was too bad. They just expected them to stay in these
They tried know, to kill them on the death march.
Right, exactly. Right.
And that's an interesting thing, too. So, I mean, fairly ubiquitous is discussion of Bataan Death March. People know that story to some degree, but this is connected directly to that.
These are all survivors of the Death March.
So they've got them in this camp. This is in the Philippines, y'all. And the Japanese Imperial Army's there, got them in this camp. Word's out that, and they showed themselves already, the Japanese, that they're going to kill the American POWs. Word gets in, and the Great Raid, as it's called, the most amazing, the biggest, most successful raid in American history, the entirety of it, happened. And your dad was one of those Rangers.
He was. Around January the 25th, they made a decision that they would send troops in to try to liberate the POWs from the Cabanatuan POW camp. Lieutenant Colonel Henry Musi was the commander of six Rangers, and Captain Robert Prince was his, I guess, XO would be the best way to put it. But he was given about 48 hours to come up with a plan to travel 35 miles behind Japanese lines, execute the raid, rescue the POWs, and get out.
I mean, this
with 110 Rangers.
110 Rangers, and no... I mean, anything the military does, we think about it. They train. Here's the mission. We're going to train for it. They didn't have a chance to train for this.
Correct. They had 72 hours to plan it and leave.
I mean, think about it. And when you hear the details of this, no training. They decide here's the plan. I mean, it comes to the point where I know that like some of the diversions, like they had a plane fly over and do some stunts and backfire the engine to help gave them cover for landing these Rangers. And I think they had help from some Philippine folks that
were local.
Right,
there were Philippine guerrillas, and there were also a group of people called the Alamo Scouts, and they were the Alamo Scouts were responsible for gathering as much intel as they could. And, of course, this camp is 35 miles, you know, behind enemy lines, which was quite a feat in and of itself, getting that information back. They called it the Bamboo Telegraph.
Okay.
And
because those Alamo Scouts were out in front of even the Rangers, right, getting the intel.
The Alamo Scouts were getting intel. A couple of them were actually in a little building across the street from the POW camp and was sending information back by word, you know.
I heard, like, I think in some of the Alamo Scouts, I know the Filipino guerrillas were doing this, but some of the Alamo Scouts, so American Fighting Forces, put the straw hats on and, like, and blended in. Y'all think about
that's
like,
right.
Like, Wayne just said, you're that far behind enemy lines.
Right. Yeah, they disguised themselves as native Filipinos, got as close as they could, made notes, sent them back via courier, you know, which was dangerous, you know, because, like I say, they were surrounded. There were 350 Japanese soldiers in the camp when the raid started.
And there were, if I remember, there was a force of 1,000 somewhere close that
by,
they were.
Right. And those are the ones that the Philippine guerrillas held off. There was
at
a river.
Bridge, right?
Right. There was a bridge at Cabo River, and they blew the bridge to keep the Japanese from coming across the bridge to keep them away from the POW camp. Because once the raid started, it was less than a mile to the camp from where this 1,000 troops were.
Right. So the Japanese, if that bridge wouldn't have been blown, the Japanese would have been brought the reinforcements in from those troops we just talked about and cut off any kind of exit for our Rangers and the POWs.
Exactly right. And probably would have got there and been able to exterminate the Rangers, you know,
coming
to take care of that.
Coming right back. More with Wayne Biggs. The most daring raid of World War II, I'd say the most daring raid, the most successful rescue of American history. Continue that discussion when we return.
This This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Right, 118 FM Talk 106.5, and happy Veterans Day. Thank you to our veterans out there and our discussion of veterans from all the wars, specifically talking about the heroism of Wayne Biggs' father in World War II, dubbed the most daring raid of World War II. Y'all think about that, first of all. The scope of that, what happened at me, and the biggest rescue mission ever in American history. It actually, things I've read, Wayne, that not just the Rangers, that is part of the motto now too, but what was done on that raid is textbook for teaching going forward.
Yes, it is. That's my understanding, that they still teach that in some of the strategy classes at West Point and some of the other military.
Something that they didn't get to drill.
Correct.
They put together, they put this plan together. No drilling. They had 72 hours to make this happen, because y'all, like, pretty good chance the Japanese were going to kill all those POWs.
Exactly. And an interesting thing, and I have not been able to totally verify that this is accurate, but the plan for the raid, he actually drew it out in the dirt with a stick, like you would a football play in your backyard.
This is legendary stuff. Absolutely. I want to talk about, and your father, one of those selected. First of all, your father's name?
Edward.
Okay. Edward came from where?
He came from Peterman, Alabama.
Okay.
Up in Monroe County.
Okay. And he is, he ends up being in six Rangers.
Correct.
Yes. And one of how many, once again? Rangers, just over 100,
Right, chose about 110. It was two platoons. It was 1st and 2nd platoon of C Company, and for the military guys out there, Charlie Company.
But it wasn't everybody. So Wayne was telling me, too, during this, the selection process, as they're picking the Rangers to go on this, what'd they do?
They had to be single.
That already is going to scare me if I'm...
They could not be married, and because it was deemed a suicide raid.
I mean, we're going to try, but probably higher up in command probably didn't think back. They're not coming back.
Exactly. And some of the interesting things about that, and that was Colonel Henry Musey. He obviously was a brilliant military mind.
Yeah, didn't he end up being like Mac V. Sogg in Vietnam or something like that? I think he was one of those guys that kept teaching. Like,
you know, I'm not sure about that.
But I mean, that name. Like his planning, this thing is like really big. This is like...
Oh, absolutely. It is still considered the greatest rescue mission in military history. And like I say, they do teach the raid and the specifics of it and the design. And the amazing thing is that I spoke to Captain Robert Prince just a month or two before he passed away several years ago. I'd got his contact information and left it, and he called me back. We had about an hour long conversation, and it was amazing. And how he deflected all of the credit and everything to the soldiers.
That generation?
Oh, absolutely. It's like my father-in-law. He was in Patton's army in Italy, from North Africa all the way up to Northern Italy, liberating all of that area.
Brutal
when
fighting.
Asked about how he won his Bronze Star, you know, he said, "I was just doing my job."
That campaign up the peninsula was brutal.
Absolutely.
Brutal.
Absolutely.
So here we are in the Pacific. We've got this... you've got the 72-hour window, because chances are the Japanese are going to kill these folks.
Correct.
So without drilling and doing all the stuff the military does and super plans and blueprints, possibly drawn out in the dirt, this plan goes. We get the Rangers in there. They land. You said it was 30 miles behind it, 30 miles behind
35
it.
35 miles behind.
Okay. Enemy lines. The Apache scouts are in there. Relaying information. There's nowhere to run. There's no close line for if it goes badly.
No, sir. You're on your own. You know, it's going to turn out well, or it's going to turn out really bad.
And obviously, because we're talking about it, it turned out well, but how this happens. So they go in, and it's a nighttime mission.
It is. They actually had to, Sean, the way the camp was laid out was there was a huge... What do they call that, where they clear it way out around so you can shoot?
Oh, yeah, like a firing lane.
Firing lines or whatever. But there are several hundred yards of just pure flat land that they had to
around this camp.
Around the camp that they had to traverse on their bellies in the daylight so that they could be in position
in the dark.
So that when
they made that transition in the daylight?
So they did. And that's why they brought the plane in.
Okay, yeah, and this is what I'm talking about.
As to fly over the camp as a diversion.
That's when they made their move.
To help them crawl across that field.
You just connected two things from that story I never knew. So, yeah, P-61, I think Nighthawk comes in, does some aerobatics, backfires its engine.
Right.
That's when they're crossing that open ground?
Yeah, all the Jap guards and soldiers are all looking up in the air at the plane.
And the Rangers are advancing.
And they're crawling as quick as they can across there to cover as much of that land as they could so that they could get in a position. And the raid started about 7:35 at night.
Okay, so it's dark.
It got dark. They waited until the camp had kind of settled down, and the Japanese soldiers got in to their barracks,
mm-hmm.
and they had designed the way the raid was designed. They knew where the barracks were that held the prisoners. And so they completely encircled three sides of the camp except for the area where the POWs were barracked.
Okay, so they had that intel. I was wondering how they wouldn't hit the—
They knew the layout of the camp, and so they went in, and 7:35, the first shot rang out. 2.5 hours later, 350 dead Japanese soldiers. They did lose two Rangers. Possibly the educated guess is that one of them was actually friendly fire, unfortunately. But they evacuated all of those POWs and did not lose a single one.
Now, think about this. Not only the Rangers, you add the 500 POWs there that would all be— these are all targets for the Japanese. Lose two Rangers, mm-hmm. and 350 Japanese killed. It's an amazing thing. I mean, to sit there and think about that level of success. Not just like you won the battle, you won it, and then you're doing that while you're moving people that can hardly stand up. They've been starved to death by the Japanese and beaten and tortured and broken bones.
They had to—
you're not like a bunch of healthy Ranger farm boys. Right. They had to haul these other people with them.
Exactly. And that's one of the few things that my dad ever said. I did not know about this raid until I was 35 years old.
So you told me this. This is what shocked me.
He had passed away at that time. But
your mama told you, right?
My mother told me.
How'd that happen? Tell me that story.
Well, there was a History Channel documentary going to be on that night. My mother calls me and says, hey, you need to watch this History Channel documentary tonight. It's about the raid where your dad won his Bronze Star.
And you're like, what?
I'm puzzled. I'm like, what are you talking about?
And you're in your 30s at this point, right?
Yeah, I'm like 35, 36 years old.
And he's
been dead for 12 years.
And you had no idea?
I had no idea.
So this documentary comes on?
Yeah, and I watched it, and just it blew me away.
What was that like? I mean, sitting there watching the accounts of something, that's your dad, man.
Yeah. I love it. There's a movie called The Great Raid, right. And of course Hollywood took some liberties with the storyline and mm-hmm. everything, but it's pretty close to accurate. Matter of fact, Captain Robert Prince was one of the consultants on the movie. And so I love it when my kids and my grandkids, and if they're around and it's on, we'll watch it. And at the very end, it says, this raid is still considered to be the greatest military rescue raid in the history of the U.S. military. And my wife, and she is always so good. She said, how does that make you feel knowing your dad?
Yeah, I have the same question she does.
Yeah. And
what does that feel
like? I'm like,
this is the guy that raised your dad.
It's pride, of course,
mm-hmm.
but it's really no more pride than knowing that my son gets up every day and goes to work, and he did two combat tours in Iraq, and
just doing his job, right?
Just doing, as my father-in-law would have said, just doing my job. But it is so much pride.
And it is amazing too. I mean, this raid that happens under, once again, I mean, the sand, I just in my brain, I picture sand through the hourglass, this window before these people would be killed. And it wasn't a theory. The Japanese had already just done it. Mm-hmm. Right. So so it wasn't like, oh, well, they might. They're
going to
kill him.
They're going to do it. Right.
And that we were in a footing, too, you think about, where somebody higher up said, go for it, guys.
That is correct. Yes. And there were some interesting details. Now, like Colonel Musi obviously was a very religious man. Mm-hmm. And he did a couple of things before the raid. Number one, like I said, I think earlier that no married men, all had to be single because it was basically a suicide raid. But the other thing that he did, he handpicked these two platoons. And I don't know that they were the entire platoons, because I think he had to sort out the married men from mm-hmm. the single, and then he offered them the opportunity to unvolunteer.
He gave them the chance to say no.
He gave them the chance to say no, and none of them backed out. But his first order to the group was, I don't care if you believe in God, if you're an atheist, I don't care, but I'm giving you an order. You're going to the chaplain, and you're going to pray that we get every one of those POWs out without exception, and that if we don't, we die trying.
Let that settle in, and we'll come right back. More with our discussion of Wayne Biggs.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
FM Talk 106.5 and Midday Mobile on this Veterans Day. Glad to have you along, and just an amazing conversation with my friend Wayne Biggs. Usually we're talking about politics and what's going on, you know, traffic-wise in Saraland, but we talk about these generational families service to our military, and this is absolutely one. I want to read just a couple of these texts quickly, Wayne, then we'll get back into it. B-Dark says, Sean, this is one of the best shows I've heard in a long time. I wish I could be there, and I want to thank all veterans, their wives, and children for their service. God bless them all. God bless
Amen.
You. Texter says, great history lessons about the prisoner rescue in the Philippines. And this is, it needs to be a lesson, because it has now had a movie, and there's Hampton Sides, the book, you know.
Right.
But this is the stuff of American pride and legend here. And your dad was one of those Rangers. It's not like we're even talking about battalions of people. We're talking about 112 something.
Yeah, 110, 112 guys.
Yeah. And you talked about selection process. Think how y'all feel. And Wayne, describe it again. So they're saying, okay, if you're married, think about this. And the Rangers are tough guys, but if you're married, we don't need you. Mm-hmm. We don't want you to go, because they don't want to leave widows at home.
Right.
Right? That's the message. By the way, y'all are going to go get right with God.
Right.
You know, and we leave in 72 hours.
That's right. Exactly. And oh, by the way, before you go, we're going to take an individual picture of each one of you, because it might be the last recollection of you being alive.
And he gives you a chance to say no, and these men still say yes.
Every man to a man said yes.
Unbelievable. So this raid goes on, and we talk about this, I mean, beyond overwhelming success in the liberation of 500 POWs that we pointed out are the product of the Bataan Death March.
Correct.
It's not like they were in the fighting shape they were. These people are truly skeletons in some of the pictures.
Exactly.
They've been beaten, tortured, starved. The Rangers and the guerrillas, Philippine guerrillas fighting with us, now have got to not only get themselves out. You talked about, they blew the bridge. The Japanese Imperial Army is right there. They killed 350. There's another 1,000 right there.
Correct.
Coming to kill them. Now it's not just escape, but it's escape with 500 people that can't even hardly walk.
Correct. Yeah. Basically 500 invalids. And we discussed, you know, Captain Juan Pajota, who was the head of the Philippine guerrillas, he had basically told them, give me 24 hours and I will have you all the caribou carts that we need to transport. So Within a short distance from the camp itself, they had a lay down yard of caribou carts.
So they're working
oxen. So
they were 24 hours before that, and they're Filipinos, so they can move along the people saying, "Hey, we're gonna need. I need this water buffalo. I need this cart. I need this water buffalo. This cart."
Exactly how it played out,
and that's how they moved them.
That's how they moved them all. Yes.
So now
the ones that could walk, the ones that couldn't rode in the caribou carts.
Okay. You and I were talking about this during the break. I'm no major military strategist. I'm just a hayseed. But now you've got awesome rangers that physically can probably outrun people. But now you've got 500 people that can't. And not only that, you can't go through rice paddies and jungle and hide and lay behind things. You got to go on the road.
You got to get on the road.
If I'm the exactly Japanese right. Imperial Army, I go, you know, I got an idea. They're going to be on the road.
Exactly. Yeah. So you have opened yourself up to, you know, as a target. Trying to, you know, you've rescued them from the camp. Now you've got to get them, you know, 35 miles to an area where it's safe
or
an area that's relatively safe.
So think about it this way. Those of y'all in shape, let's walk/run 35 miles. First of all, y'all in shape. Now we're going to have you go through a night of warfare and run/walk 35 miles. And yeah, by the way, you're going to be hauling the rest of the people you just rescued from the POW camp.
Exactly. Who are suffering from every kind of imaginable jungle disease that you can get.
Yes.
Beriberi, cholera, you know, dysentery, you know, you name it. And these guys, you know, some of them are way less than 100 pounds.
The pictures, y'all, and I know you've seen some of it, the pictures are shocking to see what these POWs look like. And so you can only, as a group here, you can only go as fast as the slowest cart or the slowest man.
You're right. You're right.
I don't care if you're a well-trained, you know, well-trained ranger. It doesn't matter because you got to get these people 35 miles back to lines.
Yeah. Even though the raid lasted 2.5 hour firefight, the battle is not over because, like you said, you have to get those people to safety. Yeah. Now, there is one, you know, in every dramatic situation, mm-hmm. there's always one humorous thing that happens.
Okay. Help me here.
It seems as though that there was one POW who did not get rescued that night from the camp.
He got left.
He was totally deaf, and he had been suffering from dysentery for weeks. He went into the latrine before the raid started.
He didn't
fell asleep.
Had no idea what was going on.
Deaf as a doornail. He did not hear a thing. He woke up the next day, and all the POWs were gone, and the Japanese soldiers were dead. And he was rescued later that afternoon by somebody.
Maybe Philippine guerrillas or something.
But he literally fell asleep.
Can you imagine? You go to sleep. You're in a Japanese POW camp being starved to death, beaten to death. And then you go to the train, pass out. You wake up. Your captors are dead, and all your fellow POWs are gone.
They're gone. Yeah, yeah.
Well, you're not missing the boat. You're like, wait, where'd everybody go?
Exactly. So I always enjoy that little bit of levity in that story.
But they did get him.
They did get him, yes.
I mean, it is amazing, too, not only because I want to pick up back where we're in the narrative, but even to go back in a second, that raid was done, that attack on 350 Japanese soldiers there, and they didn't shoot any POWs or
did not lose a single one.
Y'all think about that for a second.
Moosey's ordered prayers were answered.
Absolutely. He said, not a single one.
He said, we will get
nighttime
them all
battle.
Out alive, or we will die trying.
Nighttime battle against 300, well, you know, well outmatched.
Well-trained, well-armed.
Yes.
I mean, you know, they had tanks, and they had a tank in a shed at the POW camp, and they were a well-armed army.
And you do that, and you don't touch a hair on a POW's head.
It's amazing.
So now they got to get back. There's 35 miles. They've got, so picture this, y'all. Here we got the Rangers, we got the Philippine guerrilla forces, and we have these POWs in carts being pulled by water buffalo.
Mm-hmm.
And they're heading for the line.
Heading for the American lines, the safe line. Exactly. And it took, obviously, it took several days because, and I say that because the first group of Rangers who had participated in the raid got back to the American lines far enough that General MacArthur presented Musi and Prince with their Silver Stars and some of the Rangers with their Bronze Stars. My dad was two or three days later getting
it, the line
there.
Was that spread out?
It was. It took them, and I'm guessing, I don't know what caused such a delay, but it could have been the condition. You know, they were taking them to, I think, to Cabanatuan City, which was about 10 miles away, that had been under Japanese control, but had kind of since been liberated. And they took them there and were giving medical care to a lot of the POWs. But yeah, he was like three or four days later getting back. And so they were kind of stretched out.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, it is some providence. Because, I mean, you just painted a picture that four stretched out on a road. For the Japanese Army, you just painted a picture like, we're gonna smoke y'all.
Easy pickings.
Mm. We know where you're going. You're moving at the speed of a POW with dysentery and broken bones.
Right.
You're on a road, and you're stretched out. And they made it.
They all made it back. Now, another side to this story involves my son. If you're ready to go there.
Yes, absolutely. You just talking about you were just out on the West Coast.
Yes.
He's a Marine.
Right. And at the time all of this occurred, he was stationed in Okinawa. He was there for about 2.5 years. He was a sergeant at the time. And every other year, the United States military and the Philippine military do a joint exercise. They call it Balakawan, I believe. But this is 2010.
Okay.
And so I knew that Matt was being sent to the Philippines for about 6 weeks. No details or anything. He just said, I'm not going to be on the island of Okinawa. I'm going to be in the Philippines. And he would call me every once in a while because he was a comms guy.
Okay.
He could get his hand on the sat phone. Yes. He could call me. And he calls me, Sean, one day and says, Dad, you're not going to believe where I'm at. And he's, you know, at the time, he's probably 23, 24 years old. And I'm like, you're not in the brig.
Yes. What trouble have you got into, Marine?
That's how a dad thinks, you know. Mm-hmm. And he says, no, Dad, I am at the Cabanatuan POW camp.
Holy cow.
I'm like, you have got to be kidding me, man. He said, yeah. He said, my CO came up. And he said, you know, we got comm guys. You turn around, you bump into a comm guy. He said, but the CO, who was a lieutenant colonel, comes up to Matt and says, Biggs, I need a radio operator. We're sending a detail over to the shrine, is how he put it. He called it the shrine, to do a cleanup detail.
Okay.
And he said, I need a radio guy. I need a comm guy. So you're it. Matt had no idea where they were going. They get in a truck.
Did the commanding officer, did he know?
He had no idea.
He didn't go, Biggs, this is the same?
He had no idea.
Oh, my.
So they get to Cabanatuan, and around, it's a monument now. It's a park, you know, like a military.
Right.
And they have all these monuments, and one of the monuments is a big stone monument, has all of the Rangers' names engraved in it that took place in the raid, has all of the POWs on another one, and the Alamo scouts and everything. And so Matt just called me to say, I'm standing here looking at this monument with my granddad's name on it. Now, he never met him because he had already passed away. So
yeah,
in just a little bit, his CO is looking at the same
monument. Gosh.
So Matt goes over and says, see that Specialist 5, Edward L. Biggs, right there? And then the CO's like, yeah, any relation? He said, that was my grandfather.
I bet you could have heard a pin drop.
Could have. Matt thought that was the end of it. The next day, his CO says, Sergeant Biggs, you're going to be participating in a wreath-laying ceremony here at the end of the week that we're doing. And it was...
I mean, what are the odds, Wayne, that he's standing there where his grandfather...
It was providential. It was an American general, a Philippine general, an American admiral, a Philippine admiral, and Sergeant Matthew Bruce from Sherland, Alabama, putting this wreath, you know. And they were so great to him. He said those admirals and generals, they wouldn't take a picture without him in it. And when he gets back to Okinawa, the Marine Corps there has a really nice publication that they do. And so they did two or three page spreads on Matt, his granddad, the raid, and Matt being there. But I told him, son, that is not coincidence. No. That's providential.
The fact that, out of all this stuff leading up to this point, too, to have him there and then have the commanding officer say, like you said, I've heard the same thing with the comms guys. There's a lot of comms guys. He picks him, picks Matt. Right.
Yeah. What are the odds?
Without any prior knowledge.
He had no idea until Matt pointed out his granddaddy's name on that stone that there was any connection.
Unbelievable. Yeah. Unbelievable. All right, we're coming right back. More of our discussion with Wayne Biggs. Hey, you talk about a family affair like so many families out there that serve. It's all through their bloodline. Coming right back.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 and Midday Mobile. Glad to have you along. This segment of the show is brought to you by my friends at Paris Tractor, specifically by buddy Blaine Price at Paris Tractor. Skid steer. We talked about it earlier in the week. Not only getting the skid steer, but getting the skid steer delivered. That was... It's pretty awesome, Blaine. Thank you. That's quite a service, because not all of us have a truck that can pull a skid steer.
That's right. We've got plenty of those skid steers, just like you got over there right now, Sean, in stock, for sale and in our rental department. And like you said, delivery available. If you don't have the truck to haul it, we do and we will. So we've got all the open cabs, the enclosed cabs, high flow with all the attachments in stock. But we also have some used ones in as well that we've traded in. I think I got five or six used skid steers, so if you're not looking to buy brand new, that's another option as well. So definitely come by, see us, check us out. We've got the zero interest financing through Kubota on all the skid steers right now, so you can bundle that in with all the different attachments that you need. We've got all those in stock and get that zero interest financing right now through Kubota.
How's your selection on RTVs looking?
We've got quite a few RTVs just in time for hunting season. We've probably unloaded three or four semi-truck loads in the past 2 days here in Robertsdale, all different colors, all different sizes in gas and in diesel. So still zero interest financing on them as well. So come by, check it out.
All right. Tell folks how to find you.
We're right here at Paris Tractor in Robertsdale on Highway 59. Come by, see us Monday through Friday, 8 to 5, or give us a call at 251-947-4171, and you can visit us online at ParisTractor.com.
Thank you, Blaine.
Thanks, Sean.
All right, there goes Blaine over at Paris Tractor. And wrapping up our conversation for now with our friend Wayne Biggs, I would read a couple texts here quickly. This coming from C.B. Carl, who was on another veteran. He said, Sean, I've known a lot of heroes with awesome stories, but all I can say about this story is damn. Jason says, Sean, Mr. Biggs is a terrific guest, and I'll add that the people of Saraland missed out. This texter says, incredible show today. I had a customer that was 16 years old when he was on the beach at Normandy with his older brother, and they both survived. This from an unnamed texter said, my husband's father died on the Bataan Death March.
So, wow.
And this was rescuing, if y'all don't know the story, this is the people that made it through the Bataan Death March that were rescued by the Rangers, one of them being Wayne's dad here. Incredible. And you also mentioned, if we just got a few minutes left here too, the connections here are robust, right? I mean,
yes.
And it just still has the hair stand up on my arm that your son is there at the monument, gets called up by his commanding officer as comms guy to the monument where his grandfather took part in the greatest raid in American history in hostage rescue.
Amen.
Amazing. Then you mentioned Burt Bank. And I started my radio career in a studio called the Burt Bank Studio at the University of Alabama.
Right.
And Burt Bank, people know Alabama Radio Network, all that. this guy? What's his relation to this?
Well, Burt Bank was Captain Burt Bank, and of course he was blind, so they did not ship him to Japan to work in the munitions plants, and so he stayed at he was a prisoner at Cabana Tuan, and I knew that he had been a prisoner there because I had read Hampton Sides' books, The Ghost Soldiers of Cabana Tuan, and he was prominently mentioned in there because he was one of the ranking officers as mm-hmm. a captain. So one day I've been listening to the programming on 106.5 all day long, and the Feinbaum show is coming on. I'm listening to Feinbaum, and he mentions that going toward a break that coming up in the next segment, Mr. Burt Bank was going to be a guest. And so I call 1-800-SAY-PAUL or whatever, the number is, and call Paul and just told the guy the story. His screener told him the story that, you know, that Burt Bank had been a POW in the Philippines and that my dad was a ranger that participated in a raid that rescued him. Well, they put me to the top of the list.
I imagine.
And so for 3 or 4 minutes on the Feinbaum show, I'm talking to Mr. Burt Bank, and just, you know, he was genuinely curious and wanted to know about my dad. Unfortunately, he had passed away at the time from cancer, but, you know, and talked about how they were heroes. And my response to him was, you know, you were all heroes because, number one, those 500 POWs never gave up that fighting spirit. Mm-hmm. The moment that raid started and the firing started, there were all indications to the POWs who were in their barracks area that the Japanese had begun to exterminate the prisoners because they had heard about that.
Yep.
They knew what was going on, and they were fearful. And when the Rangers came running into their barracks to rescue them, they were ready to fight. They had sticks and anything they could get their hands on to fight these guys, and it was just amazing. There's a website of descendants of the Cabana Tuan Death March, and I happened to talk to a lady one time whose grandfather was rescued from Cabana Tuan, and she was just so genuinely appreciative. She said, you know, without your dad and those other 110 guys, I wouldn't be here.
Yeah, and there's so many.
So, what would we have missed as Americans if those 500 guys had died?
It's unbelievable. I mean, there's these stories through the Greatest Generation that, by the way, as we close this out, your father never told you about.
Correct. He never mentioned it. He had been dead for 15 years before I ever found out that he had done anything remotely resembling this.
Well, thank you to your family. Thank you to your father. Thank you to your son. Thank you.
Thank you, Sean.
Come back and see us soon.
I will do it.
Wayne Biggs, Paul Feinbaum Show, speaking of which, is on the way next.
Up your voice. FM Talk 106.5 WAVH FM, Daphne Baymanette Mobile.